And most Indian people who are successful in the field find themselves involved in just about everything. You know, you get a guy out of jail and you find you have to take care of his chemical dependency problem, if he has one, and he perhaps has if he's got a long list. And then you have to take care of the welfare problem of supporting the people. And coming from a background of sharing, we get into these things. And since 1968, I've had a very dynamic and progressive education, because I've learned to write proposals that white people took 10 years to develop the criteria for and to get funded. And it's been an amazing education in terms of writing just proposals and specific categories for getting those kinds of things funded. At the offshoot, as an offshoot of the American Indian Movement, we got into juvenile delinquency. And from juvenile delinquency, getting Indian children out of the juvenile detention system, we had to, one day in 1970, we discovered, I worked then as a staff psychologist for Lutheran Deaconess Hospital. And I discovered one day that my staff and I, there were nine of us, had directly paroled to us from the juvenile detention system 115 kids. We had the papers for any charge from absenteeism, truancy, joyriding, sniffing, and the whole works. They were all Indian kids who we had gone before the juvenile judge and said, we don't want those kids to go to Red Wing, because Red Wing had an instrument that they felt was very valuable called positive peer group pressure, which means that you have to strip yourself psychologically of any belonging to culture or heritage that our kids were positively identifying with. And so they were doing the reverse in what we were trying to do in the family setting. So, you know, we had to provide an alternative to the juvenile justice system, and so we created what we now call the survival school system. When we started in 1970, we started because we needed a central location for the children that we had. And being an urban Indian practically all my life, it's different than being a reservation Indian. The problems are multiple because we don't have a political force. We're not all Democrats or we're not all Republicans. We're not familiar with precinct caucuses or senatorial caucuses. And we don't know what a state delegate is, and we don't know what the state platform committee is, and all of those things. I happen to be familiar with that because I know that's where the best benefit for Indian people are. So basically, I'm going to talk about those two subjects tonight, the Indian education and politics, and how that could best benefit. And I'm not a politician, by the way, and I'm not running for office. But I need to relate my experiences and how difficult it is as an Indian person to be absorbed in this process that was established by the dominant society, by their rules and regulations. In 1970, we had the 115 kids. And I want to take you, you know, with me in a walk-along experience and pointing out to you the difficulties that urban Indians have when they have an idea. We started off with 115 kids who were paroled to us, and we were answerable to the juvenile justice system, Judge Lindsay Arthur and his referees. He had five. And they were all paroled into our custody. And I had no way of telling at any one given time. The parole officers were so against us at the time because we went against their recommendations. Their recommendations were to send the Indian children to Red Wing and Sauk Center and Lena Lakes. Ours was that the problem was in the community and we as Indian people could take care of it, you know, and they wouldn't be back in the system. But we were not articulate enough to develop that criteria that they had laid down as being an alternative. So we took the 115 kids over to the police community gym on Franklin Avenue, 15th and Franklin, and we used the gym to start off culture classes. And our first effort was to strengthen the image of our Indian children so that they could effectively pay the price for being Indian in a dominant white society. And so we found that this was working. But, you know, we sang songs and we taught the Chippewa language, and we talked about some of the history of the Chippewas in the state of Minnesota. But we found that after the kids began to identify as Indian people, that their neighbors had a lot of influence on them, and they were, you know, heavy on math and reading and these kinds of things, and they were falling back. So then we, at one point, went down to 98 children. And then it came back up, the number came back up, and so they were demanding that we put in some of the academic curriculum based on Indian interpretation. Now, talk about a heavy job. That was a heavy job. None of us were academically oriented. But we do have that in our survival school system today, because we worked at it. The survival school system, the heart of the earth especially, has been going for 5 years. Red Schoolhouse has been going a similar amount of time. We just opened one about 7 months ago in Rapid City. We do have the cooperation of the Board of Education, but developing the curriculum for the kids was probably one of the most difficult tasks, and none of the people involved were educators of any kind, except that we had to reinterpret to their best understanding. And we found that most of the kids eventually went back to the public school system with confidence and self-esteem, a high self-esteem, and because of their knowledge of themselves. And so we grappled and struggled for 5 years for the survival school system. Well, while all of this was going on, people had to take care of the kids. You know, they had to take care of over 100 kids. None of us didn't have any money. We were, you know, I was subsidized by my job, but yet I had to spend 8 hours elsewhere a day, you know, getting the school together and doing as much as I could there. But my job was to write proposals for different foundations. And we went to, I think our first block of money came from an outfit called the Elliott Foundation and Shaker Foundation in Chicago. And we got $500 from one and $1,000 from the other. $1,500 to take care of the kids for a whole year. You know, and we had 100 and some kids. We had to provide transportation, food, and reading and writing materials. We approached the school board 100 times in 1 year, you know, with the kids and the staff and everybody, and said, listen, we need your help, you know. You don't fit the category, you know. You don't fit the category for free schools or open schools, and you're not an alternative school, and we can't give you credit, and we can't give you any money. If we can't give you the credit, we can't give you the money. And so, you know, we're saying, and Clyde says it all the time, you know, we're taking care of your juvenile detention problem, you know, and the courts recognize us. Why can't you recognize us financially? And they still haven't done that. You know, there still is an appropriation that goes into the school system. Somebody is getting $1,100 through tax appropriations for those kids. Now, some of us have learned that we have to research that. We're going to have to whip the law, you know. And so we're going to have to, one of us is sitting down researching the law to change it so that our schools like ours, who have a uniqueness, will be able to survive in this system. And that's what the survival school system is all about. But we got $1,500 from them, and we started going around, and we got a grant from OEO. We never actually ever got the money until last week, you know. But they paid us for 3 years ago that they awarded us a grant, and we've been in court all of this time to justify that we were not a ripoff organization, you know, and that the money really did go to the kids. But we had to go out and get attorneys who would be interested. And so all of these things are current, and they're now going on. And we find that the biggest difficulty in the future of the survival school system is the ignorance of the people who are in the administrative decision-making positions, that they don't really understand what oppression really is. You know, can people who are in the middle class environment, who have safe, positive contributions to make as administrators, can they really look at oppression in the face and acknowledge that there are oppressed people in our present state of abundance or bountifulness? And they can't. You know, there's no way that I'm working on a project in St. Paul as an Indian planner, and I've learned the game of lobbying. You know, if you can take one of the legislators or one of the councilmen out to lunch and you can have an hour and a half, you have a better chance of getting his vote by telling him how poor and how oppressed Native Americans are. And I got 5 votes for tomorrow's meeting, you know, for $31,000 for my job. And of course, you know, when my survival comes to be important, I know how to lobby that well. You know, I can convince anybody that they have to pay for my salary. So I did spend 2 weeks lobbying councilmen. But see, that's where the value of learning about the urban society is, you know, in learning where the politics plays an important role in our lives today. Even you people there your lives are controlled by the laws that are being passed. And when you go to committee hearings, last year, when I was a lobbyist for the Indian Affairs Commission, I went to all of the significant committee hearings that were of interest in the state legislature and in the Senate. And I noticed that there wasn't very many public-spirited people at those meetings. And here are these 35 guys passing laws and making laws among themselves without an audience, you know, of reaction, no citizen participation. And then after the legislation closed, I go to these meetings of concerned parents, and they're saying, them legislators, they voted this way, they shouldn't have done that. And then I get up and I said, well, I didn't see you at those committee hearings when they were making those decisions, you know. And so there are a lot of things happening, you know, that are eye-openers in terms of those committee hearings. The Committee on Education, the Committee on Juvenile Delinquency, the Committee on Government, the Committee on Committees, you know, all of those things, they're, you know, we're paying these legislators top salaries to make decisions, and we give them the resolutions to look over and to make into bills, and you might see 4 people in those committee meetings. You know, and those guys are up there smoking and laughing and joking, and then they make the wrong decision, and the community comes down on them, you know, and so I think it's of interest, at least for the Native American section, to get articulate and to be at every single one of those hearings. And I hope to do that. In the coming 2 years, I'm going to train Indian people to sit in on every legislative committee hearing that goes on in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, because they spend millions of bucks there. $100 million and for different programs, housing programs. I fought for a housing program in Minneapolis, and we only got $2 million for it. They passed a bill for $40 million last year for housing, the same kind of program that I had fought for 5 years in the housing area. And so, but I was not aware that the legislature had the power to allocate those kinds of monies. So I was going to the wrong place. I was going to the Revenue Sharing Committee of the city in its community development function. It's important that we both be there, but that we be in both places. But one is better than the other, you know, because if you lose at one, then you can go to the other one and to develop housing. But the needs are not equal. They're not brought forth to the point that people can do things. Someone asked me what the current issues are. The current issues are that we need to know more about the processes of urban Indian involvement that exist today, you know. The issues are education, health, education, and welfare. Today, in the urban Indian setting, that's important, that we start to train our young people to get into the precinct caucuses, to get into those hearings, and to look at the newspapers and to begin to make Native Americans, as well as other people, to represent particular districts and to strengthen district participation so that all people can be heard. We made a presentation before the St. Paul City Council the other day, and it was the first time that all six Indian organizations, all six major Indian organizations had ever been heard from in the city of St. Paul. We talked about developing and coalescing all the Indian organizations under one roof. And so, but they had rejected us through the city planning commission process because we didn't belong to a district. Well, we never knew that we were to belong to a district. You know, we've lived all of these years just freely, you know, that but our request was not valid because we didn't represent a district, you know, or a particular area of the city of St. Paul. We were under the category of citywide criteria, and so that didn't mean that we were very politically powerful. One of the city councilmen said, well, if you go and approach the West St. Paul residence group, you would have more clout. So I went back to the Indian community and I said, well, what do you think about that? Well, we live all over the city of St. Paul. Why should we affiliate with the residence organization when we got our own residence organization? So when we went before the city council, we explained that this is why we were denied the opportunity to get into the revenue sharing processes. And now we're included because they have a heavy commitment. We made a public spectacle of this revenue sharing process. But we would not have been able to do that had we not had people like myself and other people who were involved in reading what was happening. I was never aware of community development funds or revenue sharing funds. Who votes on it? You know, how does that money get allocated? $18 million, $18.8 million is being allocated for social services needs in the city of St. Paul. $23 million is given out in Minneapolis, you know. And so Indian people are not on the boards, they're not on the citizens participating committee. We have 10,000 Indians in Minneapolis and 5 in St. Paul. So that's 15,000 urban Indians that need, without the strong strength and political power of other residential groups. And so my job is to get that information, disseminate it, take it back and interpret it to the Indian community that these things, and I had 2 days to find out that there's a hearing tomorrow that the city council had made some decisions on the Indian Multi-Service Center. And so I had 2 days to get support for the Native American group. And today I was on the phone getting all of these people together. Perhaps we'll have 100 people at the city council chambers tomorrow, and maybe not. It depends. But if we had the same kinds of time, something is wrong. We're missing our communication in terms of equality and fairness. We're not getting the information that the white people, I'm sure there'll be 1,000 white people there tomorrow, you know, vying for the same kind of funds. But somebody didn't give us the information. And so those kind of things happen daily. You know, I went to bed last night and didn't realize that there was a meeting Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock, you know, that we have to turn out. You know. Because I've been involved in the Walk for Survival and other things that I really was not in tune. And so I happen to have had some contacts that called me, and we do have now some. But that's part of the problem. People were asking about some of the issues. The issues that are going on is that the city agencies of the urban Indian, the problems that we have is that the communication and our involvement is not solicited, because citizens' groups are powerful enough, the residents' associations are too powerful, and they're into their own thing. There's no equality. You know, we went to a PAC meeting, which is called a Parents Advisory Committee meeting, in one of the Southside districts. And we decided that since the South Side represented, the South Side of Minneapolis represented a large section of Native American people, that maybe we ought to put a Native American on that PAC for the revenue and community development meeting. We didn't get a Native American on there, you know. But they had decided, someone had decided that there would be through the aldermanic appointment. He had won. And so we got one through that process. So part of the issue is being able to communicate with each other, you know, at all times. And 2 years ago, I got involved in a precinct caucus because I never saw any Indian people. For the first time in the history, the DFL party had passed 21 resolutions concerning Native Americans in health, education, and welfare on issues representing Native American needs. 21 resolutions were the state platform. I really pushed hard for that because I was a delegate, a state delegate, and my assignment was to be on the state platform. The state platform is what the legislators are to read as being the resolutions passed by its constituency. It's a blue book, and it has all of the resolutions of needs by the delegates who got together. There are 1,200 delegates. And so there's a section in there that they call human life, and that's where the Native Americans finally wound up. There were 21 resolutions. Not one of those bills were ever passed. And I understood the state platform to be, when I ran for the office, was the Bible for the state representatives. And I found, in talking to the Speaker of the House, you know, Marty Sable, saying that half of the representatives never look at that anyway. You know, it doesn't make any difference whether you pass them. But the hours of work that we got people, delegates, to support those resolutions and get them passed, it took me 115 delegates to get one resolution passed on the trials of Dennis Banks and Russell Means, you know, that the DFL party supported. And I spent days trying to rally support for that resolution, and the other 21 resolutions, we put a lot of work into it. The delegates put a lot of work into putting that platform together, and to have, you know, one of the executives of the state legislature tell me that half of the representatives, and that was true. They never based their bills based on the state platform. They base it on the political clout that the individual people have, like the Teamsters Union and the various, the Police Benevolent Association, and all of those people who can pay lobbyists to come in and get the attention of the legislators. So what I'm pointing out to you is that the Native American people are pretty far behind in terms of that kind of sophistication. But we can perhaps shorten that gap or fill that gap by educational awareness, such as what we're doing here, so that you people can have a better understanding of the needs of the oppressed people. The needs of us need to be articulated in the jobs that you're assigned to do. And, you know, the day of advocacy is almost over. I think that actions are going to be based on the people and the awareness that we've been able to instill. The days of my going to jail for a cause is almost over. You know, I'm going to go to jail for nothing, you know, a speeding ticket. Or, you know, I think that I have a feeling that we have two ways to go with advocacy. And to be an advocate of Native American people, you know, people such as Clyde Belcourt, Dennis Banks, and Russell Means, to be advocates means that they have to give up completely any social life, any kind of financial gain. There are no salaries in advocacy because people are not going to, if you're a hellraiser, they're not going to pay you for it. You know, there's no way that you can get a steady job because advocates don't get master's degrees and they don't get bachelor's degrees. But to bring out the needs and the issues of Indian people is important. And we spend many, many hours doing that, but these people, like Clyde and different ones in the movement who have articulated these needs, never draw a salary. They don't get any money from anywhere. And from day to day, they subsist on practically nothing, but their desire to bring out the information and make the awareness possible to people. And so I sometimes think about that. You know, some days I don't want to be an advocate because I can't get a job, you know, because I'm known to be a hellraiser and a radical. And in terms of the DFL party, I'm a liberal and I'm not very conservative. I'm a radical. I'm considered to be a radical. And so my delegate votes are few and far and my political power is not very much. And so I'm not going to change the political animal that exists, but I can train other people to be like they want them to be. I have that influence to change our younger people based on the experiences that I have today. And so we need to teach our younger people to be aware of the kinds of things that are acceptable and those kinds of things that are not acceptable, to learn how to best make them acceptable. And so with the survival school system came an education of writing what I call a grantsman. I have a reputation in Minnesota among Indian organizations as being a good funder of programs, basically because I took the survival school proposals and got them funded and other programs funded. And so I was able to gain a reputation as a grantsman and to be able to lobby and get programs funded. And so my services then became needed by a lot of Native American organizations. Consequently, the American Indian Movement has had the influence of starting over 37 programs in the state of Minnesota that are meaningful. The Legal Rights Center came as an offshoot of the AIM Patrol. We found that there was a need for 5 or 6 attorneys to just represent the needs of the Native Americans in the city of Minneapolis. We found that in one given day in 1968 and 69, that 48 Native Americans were being put to Stillwater and the different state institutions. That's daily, without representation, without the public defender, or without the Legal Aid Society becoming involved in representing minority people. So we went to an organization and got attorneys together to do this kind of representative attorney representation for Native Americans and blacks. And we pulled it all together, and we now have an organization that's been going for 5 years called the Legal Rights Center Incorporated, which is a black and Indian and Chicano oriented center that represents those kind of legal needs. They do the job of representation, and we had to find ways to fund these attorneys because some attorneys make $20,000, like Doug Hall makes $22,000, and some of the other attorneys in there are younger and experienced, and so we had to go out and hustle money for them. We went to the attorneys who have a tax write-off, the most successful, Favory Benson and the different more popular groups, and said, listen, you have certain monies that are charitable and they're tax deductible. Why don't you put some money into an organization like this? And that would be your minority sort of involvement. And so, you know, they took that, and so now they finance the Legal Rights Center. But we do have added assistance of getting the Governor's Crime Commission on prevention and control some federal monies to keep it going, like getting our community resource people. We found that paraprofessionals are better at representing sometimes the needs of Native Americans than the non-Indian attorneys. And now we're seeking out Indian attorneys to be in the legal rights field. But just basically to show you some of the difficulties that in 1959, I moved to California on a program from the BIA called a relocation program. They set me up and sent me to Los Angeles, California. The government sent me there, gave me a ticket, and they said that they were going to find me a job in Los Angeles, California. And I went there and I found that I had budgeted for this effort $1,800, and I had a family. And so when I went there, I immediately looked for Indian people. When I got to Los Angeles, the BIA said, well, you're going to stay here tonight and we're going to ride the car tomorrow and we'll find you an apartment. And so they couldn't find me an apartment. I had to go out and find it myself. I found a job for myself in Los Angeles. But I was scared to leave because I had a family. And so I wanted to look for other Indians because Los Angeles was pretty popular in Oklahoma as being a place where all...
That's right, that was true.
So I found that there was a need for a non-drinking place. And so we then began to establish what we now call urban Indian centers in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Cleveland, Chicago, Minneapolis. We found a need that when reservation people come to the urban areas that they have to go to some place to find out the information. The BIA might send them to a job over to Honeywell, and that particular department might be as prejudiced as any organization could be. Well, they can only find that out by going to an Indian representative in Honeywell who is probably working at the Native American Regional Center for interpretation. And so those kind of problems exist among us. Indian people who come from the reservation need a job, and they have to go to an Indian organization only because they can relate specific problems. The urgency of getting a job, you know, may be that the guy needs a job tomorrow. But maybe he doesn't need a job. Maybe he needs a house, and maybe he needs some place to take care and feed his children. And so these organizations, someone needs to coordinate this whole thing. So the development of urban Indian centers had to exist, and they had to come alive. It was difficult to get urban Indian centers funded because of the misunderstanding that white people, every time I go and talk about an Indian center, white people say, well, you're trying to segregate Indian people. No, we're not trying to segregate Indian people. We're trying to teach the white people that there is a need that you have to go out, and if you understand Indian people and you're in a social service giving area, that you would understand immediately, if you had some awareness, the need that separates Indian people from white people in large numbers. And so we do have a need for urban Indian centers. Maybe 5 years from now we won't need them. If everybody does their job, if everybody does their job according to the way it's laid out, maybe we don't need this. But there is no equality in the dominant society. When people talk about religion and when they talk about education, they're talking about white man's education, white man's religion. They're not talking about the Indian people. There is no equality. I don't believe that God is red because I don't see him. I think he's white because every time I go to a church, they got a picture of Jesus Christ and he's got blonde hair, blue eyes, and he's got sandals on his feet, and he's got long flowing white robes. So the projection is that he's a white man, and I don't feel comfortable with that because my mother and father are full-blooded American Indians, and I don't relate to that, and I'll never relate to that, and I don't believe that the white people are as equal as they say they are. I think they're prejudiced, they're ignorant, and they need an education. But how do they get an education? You cannot force feed people to understand the oppression when they're not oppressed themselves. And so I find myself standing up here telling stories over and over and over about the oppression of Native American people. The oppression is to get people down to understand on the streets and in the various cultures, for people to come out themselves and see if what I'm saying. I challenge you. You've had 8 speakers for the last month or so. You've had 8 speakers to come up and talk to you. I challenge you to go out and find out that if any segment of what they have to say is false or whether it's the truth that they're speaking. I challenge you to see you on the streets and to validate those stories that you've heard from those previous eight speakers. I want to see you on the streets, and I want to see you involved in asking questions where I come from, because I brought you a message. I challenge you to find out whether what I'm saying is true and to find out if there are some solutions to the problems that we have today. I challenge you to come up with some suggestions as to what are the problems and what are the possible solutions. I know that I'm running out of time, but I want to give some time to question and answers, and I would certainly be open to any questions at this time. See, even the president doesn't ask me a question.
Is there a list of any referendums or some way people can find out what laws or whatever are coming up before the community?
Yes, there is. There is in the state capitol, there is in the House and in the Senate what they call a House Research Division and the Senate Research Division, and they publish all the existing bills related, but they're not separated to minorities. Where you can go is to the Indian Affairs Commission, which is right across the street from the Capitol. I think it's 111 University, and it's the Indian Affairs Commission. You can go in there, and I think that they have it compiled, that all the Native American bills and referendums are in there. But if you're interested in the total bills that come across, you can go to Senate Research or the House Research Division, and they can give you all the bills that are currently in the House and in the Senate. Any other questions? We did several things in the last year and a half. One is we ran an Indian candidate for the school board. We ran John Poupart for the school board. And it was basically my idea to run him for the school board because I wanted to see where the white people were. He was successful in that he's got 33,000 hardcore votes in Minneapolis. That's a lot. That's really a lot. And he can do anything that he wants with those votes, according to all of the other politicians. If he runs for another office, he has a guaranteed 33,000. He may not need that to get the office. But we learned from the political analysts that that was a good thing to do. We've sat down and we've had three different sessions with the Native American community to try and convince them that they need to go to the DFL political caucuses. Of course, being a Democrat, that's where I'm going to go. But I mean, they're free to go to the Independent Republican Party if they want. But we need to get Indian people involved in this process. Last year, we started off with five people. We had five state delegates out of 1,200. This year, I anticipate that we'll have 35 Indian state delegates, because we have started from Grand Portage and over to Red Lake and those areas and International Falls, and we do have people that are interested that way. In the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul, we found that in St. Paul, they're more interested, the Indian people are more interested in the political processes. So we have about 150 that are going to be involved in all the precinct caucuses and all the primaries in the city of St. Paul. In Minneapolis, it's quite a different story. Indian people are afraid to go out and get involved in white politics because they feel the oppression already. You know, the likeliness of defeat is already there because those people have been sitting down all summer long knowing who's going to be the delegates and who's going to represent Hubert Humphrey and who's going to represent Don Fraser and Wendell Anderson and Warren Spanis for the senatorial seat that Humphrey is supposed to vacate. So they've got all of that. They're not looking at the needs of the human people. And the Indian people are saying that's hard to fight. You know, that kind of thing is really hard to fight because the political clout that you have to support Hubert Humphrey is you've got to have, a 1,000 delegate votes. I need, 100 delegate votes to get a bill through that would address the survival schools. And the Indian people are saying, we don't want to do that because it's already stacked. The decisions are already made. And when you go there and you find out that that's the truth, then it's hard to turn that around. Yes, sir.
You might give us some idea of the range of opinions that exist within the Indian community in regard to the question of the relations between Indian organizations and agencies of the federal government, including the BIA. I understand that there are differences of opinion depending upon which organization happens to be involved.
Well, I think that basically the traditional Indian people, there are organizations that are representative of the traditional Indian people who would like to maintain the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I don't know why. I think that the Bureau of Indian Affairs ought to be abolished and that we ought to go under city government, at least as an urban Indian, that the responsibilities and the fairness and equality, there ought to be a city government that's called Indian Affairs Department in the city government. But organizations, Indian organizations, probably there are, I would say, 40% that would support and endorse the efforts of the BIA because of the proposed history of BIA's involvement in the health and welfare of Indian people. The old traditional people will not let BIA go. The older people will not allow the BIA to be taken away from them. Us younger Indian people feel that that's a waste of money and too much control and power given to the U.S. government over the lives of Indian people. They have all this trust land responsibility, and that land lies fallow and not developed, and it's being wasted, and the only thing that they're putting into it is oil and gas leases and making holes in it and jerking out the oil and giving it off. That trust land responsibility needs to be let out so that land can grow and develop and give to all peoples instead of being, reserved for the oil and mineral interest. And that's what the U.S. government does with its control over the lands. And I think that you'll find that down the line there are specific issues that Indian people are united in. And that's one of the issues where they really condemn the BIA. But when it comes to really voting for the abolishment of BIA, I think it would come to a 40-60 vote. And I don't know whether we'd make it or not, but we ought to have a choice. But we don't have that choice. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is an appointed job, and the Secretary of the Interior has the control, as does the President. And it's a waste of money. There's $29 billion going into the Bureau of Indian Affairs yearly of money that really needs to be a local responsibility. I think that Indian people ought to be under the local jurisdiction in terms of health and welfare and education programs. There should be a special designation by the state, the county, and the city governments locally instead of being with federal organizations. Otherwise, we duplicate the services by going to OEO and HEW. Does that answer your question?
I assume that reservations would operate pretty much as municipalities.
Right.
I
think reservations would fight to keep the BIA because they derive the most benefit from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Urban Indian people have found an independence by living in urban areas that doesn't involve itself with the BIA. And so our concerns mainly are in the urban area, but there's a large segment of the population. Minnesota has 21,000 Indians and 15,000 of them live in in the urban areas. But most of these people are on the rolls of the reservations, and it's a transitory kind of thing.
It doesn't follow that as long as the reservation system is maintained, you're going to likely have the BIA or something like that in Washington.
I don't think so. I think there's a bill in the state legislature now that calls for the retrocession. Retrocession meaning there is a bill that retrocedes from the federal government and hands that responsibility over the state and local governments for distribution. That takes the trust land responsibility and gives it to the state. And there are six reservations who want to retrocede from federal control. And Red Lake had already done that. You know, they have never been part of the federal government or the state. Huh? Not really. I don't think it means termination. Yes, ma'am.
What would that do to the economy of the reservations if the BIA was dissolved?
Well, I believe that it would have, of course, not being representative of the reservation. You guys really put me in a trap because I'm answering like I really do know. I cannot honestly, I would imagine that it would be probably very harmful in terms of the economics, the monies and the programs that BIA sponsors on the reservation. I think that it would be very detrimental to do that. But then I'm sure that in the bills of retrocession that those existing programs are being provided for. If they're not, then whoever wrote that bill up is pretty, not aware. But I read the retrocession bill. It was in the session last year, and I think it would be replaced by the state and the state's revenue sharing process. The disbursements are made on population. The disbursements of the federal tax dollar is made based upon the population of any particular area. And so what the reservations are saying is that we are being deprived some years by an adequate distribution of those revenue sharing funds from the federal government based on our population and what we're getting because of its not being responsive in terms of the county disbursements and the state allocations. So I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. And I guess, my feeling is that it would be fair and equal to be, governed by your own people. And I think that the possibility of economic development would be much better out of the control of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Yes, sir.
From what age groups does most of the support for Indian activism come from?
I would say from about 12 to 35.
If the older Indian people are involved, how do you as an organizer deal with that?
If they are not involved, then my feeling is that I would never go into a particular project or a cause without the elderly people endorsing that effort. And I wouldn't take it up. If I didn't have older people involved with me, I would never get involved in the process. Because it's been my experience in the last, I'm 39 years old. And I've been involved in Indian work for better than, 25 years. And it's been my experience that those programs that older people are not involved in have been unsuccessful and unworthy of putting on time. And I do respect older people, despite what Dr. Paul Bo says about me. Yes, ma'am, you had another question. No, there is no bill to dissolve the BIA. The retrocession bill. What that bill does is give the law enforcement powers over to the tribes and the tribal government, which then can govern itself and give the spirit of self-determination back to the tribe, which gives the law responsibility. It cuts off the federal law responsibility and gives it to the state and local governments that would give it to the reservation. And the boundaries would be the reservation. It would only mean that the law that's enforced within the reservation boundaries be enforced by Indian people and the tribal government that exists there.
Isn't that based on a federal statute, namely Public Law 280?
Yes, that would take Public Law 280 and do away with it. Right.
But Red Lake remains a federal reservation.
Always. Right.
So that would have no effect on schools.
No, it wouldn't. It would have no effect on the education, except that with the allocations, there are some hidden things in there that is not in the bill, but it would open up the possibility of retrocession in the educational area. If you have one bill that's already passed, then education governed and supported by parents that are Native American, it has a better chance. There are some possibilities there, but that bill doesn't specifically say that. Yes, sir.
Are there other specific issues in the present legislative session in Minnesota in which you have a particular interest or a great interest to Indian people?
Yes, I do. I'm glad you asked that question. Several years ago, I am an alcoholic. And I always say that in AA meetings. So I'm going to, you know, I'm Ralph and I'm an alcoholic. That's what I usually get up and say. And I've been interested in chemical dependency for the last 10 years. And 3 years ago, we established what we call the Native American Council on Chemical Dependency. One of the reasons that we did that was because I looked at what's this thing that they go through when they appropriate monies for state agencies? They call, there's a policy statement that comes out. Once a year, they do. Anyway, Indian people were put in this plan, state plan. It's called a state plan, and it's done by all the state agencies, and they give it to the governor, and it's a state plan that's approved for the progress of state agencies within the state government. The Alcohol and Drug Division had put down the Native Americans as being the first priority. So they appropriated from the state legislature $13 million for chemical dependency programs. They gave the Native Americans, who were the first priority in the state plan, $65,000 of the $13 million. And we had the largest social disease problem in the state. So we felt that when we approached the State Alcohol and Drug Authority, they said, you don't have a representative group. You know, we just put that in there because we knew that Native Americans had the problem. If you have a representative group, then we can listen to you and develop monies and channels for more monies to go to Native American people. So we went through the state and got 55 Indian programs that were directly in the field of chemical dependency, halfway houses, detox centers, and group homes. And we had conference in Red Lake, and we had a three-day conference where we formed an organization 3 years ago that resulted in being, we were first called the Native American Advisory Board to the State Alcohol and Drug Authority. We came out with a needs assessment out of that conference. We put it forth to the State Alcohol and Drug Authority as the needs of Native Americans. Out of that came the need for a primary treatment center where an alcoholic goes to learn about, you know, they have Hazleton, they have Meadowbrook, and they have Shoreview, and they're all white programs, and Indian people have a very poor success rate there. So we designed a bill to create a Native American primary treatment center. And possibly it'll be passed in the next 2 or 3 weeks. It has cleared all the committees, and it's called an alcoholism bill, and I think the number is 1011, Senate file 1011. I'm not quite sure the number. I had it all year long, and it slips me. But there is an alcoholism bill, for those that are interested. In that bill, it's for $8 million. And in that bill, the Native Americans get $1.5 million in allocation for developing a primary treatment center and to give monies to the development of other programs. I think $500,000 of it, it specifically designates in the bill how that money is going to be appropriated. I'm particularly interested in that bill because 60% of the Indian offender programs that go to Stillwater and St. Cloud are based on crimes committed under the influence of alcohol. The juvenile detention programs is better than 70%. The Native Americans that are incarcerated in the juvenile detention system is chemical dependency as being the primary source of their criminal involvement. So I don't think that we have Indian people who are in there labeled as criminals, and they're sick people in terms of having the disease of alcoholism. And so I'm particularly interested in the progress of that chemical dependency bill. There is another bill in that has a $5 million price tag on it, and that's a housing bill that includes the reservation in urban areas. I don't particularly know the number. I wished I had anticipated that question. I'm really sorry that I do have a list of those bills. I just don't have them with me. I wasn't prepared to advocate for those bills. But I'm glad you brought that up because I did spend 2 years, you know, putting those bills together. And since the legislature will, we have 14 bills, 14 Indian bills, and they all have passed all the committees, and now they're waiting for Senate and House endorsement. And so they've had all the questions on them, and they look very favorable. I think there's probably one bill that won't get passed, and that's a bilingual and bicultural bill. It's an education bill that was put together. I don't think that bill is going to pass, because it's prejudicial and it was done by people who were not too aware. But that affects a lot of minority people, Chicanos and Indians included. But I don't think that bill, the other 13 bills have already passed all the important committees. And so I think that the closing, you know, or the beginning days of the legislature, these bills will go through. But I am particularly interested in that Indian chemical dependency bill. I'm glad you asked that question. Are there any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I can't hear you.
How many Indian youths are instituted in Kathmandu for confinement, and what kind of communication do you have with them?
How many Indian youth in Red Wing? I don't know the exact number. The last time I was involved in getting a number from Red Wing, there were 21 kids there. The communication that we did have was that there was an Indian counselor down there who used to come to the cities quite frequently. But to tell you honestly, I haven't been in touch with them in a year. And when I was into getting the statistic from Red Wing, was 2 years ago. Last year, I didn't get any communication whatsoever. So I'm really, I know there is an Indian counselor at Red Wing. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.